Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today is Tuesday, March 18th, 2025. And we're in a little different situation today. As you may notice, we're now co-chairing the committee. And thank you to Chair Scott for all her work and cooperation. And we have a really good cooperative relationship that I know is going to continue, and we're going to be really good and efficient in this committee and continue to get a lot of work done here. So the first order of business, and a quorum is present. The first order of business is approval of the minutes of March 13th. Representative Feist. All right, so Representative Feist has moved the minutes of March 13th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. So we have, before we get started, I'd just like to make a note that the committee rules have been updated just to reflect the co-chair structure, and the rules are in members' packets, and they are online if anyone wants to take a look at those, and we have agreed on those rules. And just another note that I'd like to add is that sometimes in the committee, I know members have gotten kind of the message sometimes from years of tradition that they have to bring treats when they're having a bill heard for the first time. I just want to make it clear that if a member of the committee wants to bring treats for the committee, that's just fine. But there is absolutely, on my part, no expectation that anybody needs to do that. So we have a very full agenda. I think we're going to have a pretty full agenda from now till deadline, because we've got quite a few bills that come to this committee. Many of them, in my experience, and I've even been an offender on this front, where you're carrying a bill and then suddenly toward the end, toward deadlines, you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to make a stop in judiciary. So this committee, I know, has the long tradition and burden of having things show up really late and need to be heard. So we're going to, of course, try to accommodate that. And so I just know that we're going to be very busy from now till the end. So we have given testifiers a time limit for their testimony. We're going to ask bill authors and testifiers to please be very efficient with your testimony, and also to keep your remarks to the provisions that are within the judiciary's jurisdiction, which sometimes is all of a bill and sometimes is just a very small part of a bill. So we'll try to help you with that as we move along here. So the first bill on our agenda today is House File 1662. Representative Rehrauer, if you would come up. And so because you're not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 1662 be placed on the General Register. And let's see, I don't believe there's an amendment. Oh, there is an amendment. Okay, thank you. Okay. All right, we have the A3 amendment. And Representative Rehrauer, would you like to have that moved before you start your presentation, just to get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it?
Yes, please. Thank you.
All right. So I will move the A3 amendment, author's amendment, which I think just takes a little piece out of the okay. Why don't you go ahead and just explain really briefly what that does?
Okay. So I want to thank Chair Scott and Liebling for recommending the bill be heard in judiciary, and also recommending staff to work with to ensure we get the right language for data privacy. Thank you to Nathan Hopkins in House Research and Chair Scott for helping craft an amendment. We have an amendment that ensures the language includes informed consent. Informed consent is a higher standard than a Tennyson warning, and this amendment requires informed consent for access to the MAXIS database.
All right, thank you. Are there questions to the amendment before we adopt that? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Rehrauer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair. House File 1662 is an agency bill. It will allow the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs to better assist our veterans with connecting to other state benefits more effectively and efficiently. This bill amends state statutes so that veterans program staff can access the MAXIS database, but in read-only form. And so MAXIS is a computer system managed by the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and it's used to determine eligibility for public assistance and services. So when a veteran comes in contact with MDVA staff in connection with something like the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative or other programs under that agency, this might be the only touch point that that staff member has with this veteran. And by allowing these staff members read-only access to the database, they're going to be able to quickly and efficiently connect the veteran with other services that they may qualify for. So this bill is really just a technical adjustment, and it doesn't affect the administration of benefits by DHS or DCYF. So the passage of 1662 will ensure that veterans and their families receive benefits and services in a more streamlined and efficient manner. And I have two testifiers with me today. I have Cole Trace with MDVA, and I have Andy Jarvis, Director of Veterans Programs and Memorial Affairs.
All right, thank you very much. So who would like to go first? Mr. Trace, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairs Liebling and Scott and members. For the record, my name is Cole Trace, and I am the Government Affairs Liaison for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 1662, and thank you to Representative Rebauer for carrying the bill. This bill makes changes to Minnesota Statute Section 197.065 and 13.461. These sections of law currently provide MAXIS access to MDVA for the purpose of varying eligibility status of applicants for benefits under the State Soldiers Assistance Program, which was already said. This statute has been in place for the last, since 2003, giving MDVA access for over 20 years. Over the last few years, after we've stood up the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative and other programs under agencies, Veterans Programs Division, it has become obvious that the Veterans Program staff supporting at-risk veterans within the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative also require this read-only access. And I am, at its core, this bill aims to reduce the time it takes to make eligibility determination state and federal benefits. The expansion of MAXIS access to veterans programs will allow us to more efficiently connect homeless veterans to mainstream resources by ensuring they are screened for available benefits. This is a technical adjustment and will not lead to a net change in services provided or their distribution. HF 1662 will streamline our statutes and help our efforts in supporting Minnesota's veterans, and we ask for your support. I'll now pass it over to Andy Jarvis, who, as was already said, is the Director of Veterans Programs and Memorial Affairs for the agency.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairs and representatives. Andy Jarvis, the Director of Veterans Programs and Memorial Affairs for MDVA. I'm not going to reiterate everything that both testifiers have already talked about. Just a couple points I do want to make. Again, we really see this as a technical change. We've had access since 2003, but as our organization has grown, some of our homeless programs team really found its foundations within the State Soldiers Assistance Program. And as we've grown, we've broken that out into its separate division. And so when we went back and looked at our statute, we really said we need to adjust this statute to be more accurate, because the current statute only allows staff within the State Soldiers Assistance Program to have read-only access to the MAXIS database. This only affects a small amount of staff. We're talking 5 to 10 staff increase. We've worked with DHS and DCYF on this proposal. They don't really have any concerns, are generally supportive. There was a minor concern, but that's been taken care of in the amendment that's before you as well. And there's just some tweaking of the language. Fully supportive of the informed consent amendment. We've always had a tenants and notice access to veterans about the data that we're collecting and the purposes and how we utilize that data. And those notices expire after a year, so we're not looking into them access database on individuals unless we're actively working with them on whatever their issue is and trying to resolve that. Some of the efficiencies when we're looking at this data allows us to paint a more accurate picture of someone's housing status and programs on assistance through DCYF or DHS and Social Security as well, which allows our team to better formulate housing options that are potentially available to that individual given their past experiences. And I think everything else has been touched on, so with that, I'll just available for any questions you
All
may
right.
have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the public who wants to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. We I understand the original move was to go back to veterans, and I understand we've changed that now to go to the general register.
The bill is going to the general register. I think it's already been to veterans,
yep.
hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and that's fine. I just want to make sure we didn't have to see it again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member discussion? All right. Seeing none, any closing words, Representative Rerauer?
I just want to reiterate my thank you to both of the chairs, and thank you for the support on the data privacy piece, Chair Scott. And with that, I urge your support for this bill.
All right, thank you. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1662 as amended be placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you. All right, next on the agenda, we have House File 1224, Representative Freiberg. And Representative Freiberg is not on the committee, so I will move to re-refer House File 1224 to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Representative Freiberg, you have a DE1 amendment.
Yes.
And so maybe I think in this case we should maybe go ahead and adopt it and then explain it as, and then you'll be talking about the bill as amended. Am I right?
Yeah, that would be great. The bill as drafted was intended to solve one problem. We weren't quite able to get stakeholder agreement on that issue, so we decided to use the bill to solve a different problem, which we were able to get stakeholder agreement on. That's what the DE
okay.
reflects.
And all right. So let's adopt the DE1 amendment then, and then we'll discuss the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption. Oh, I'm sorry. I will move the DE1 amendment. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE1 is adopted. And so Representative Freiberg, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Scott, for hearing this bill. During the foreclosure crisis of the mid-2000s, the legislature took many steps to address the hardship that crisis caused on Minnesota's homeowners. One of those responses included passing legislation in 2009 allowing a homeowner to postpone a mortgage sale and save the home by buying more time to come up with the amount they are behind and reinstate. The laws worked well. The reason we're here before you today is to clear up an ambiguity in our statutes regarding whether this option is available to a homeowner whose home is being foreclosed by action rather than advertisement. So most residential foreclosures are conducted by advertisement, and in those cases, the court is not involved. But due to a 2022 United States District Court decision, a federal tax lien was on a property, and the residential foreclosure was held to be required to be conducted by action. Because of that court decision, more foreclosures are taking place by action. It's crystal clear that the right to postpone a sale is available in a foreclosure by advertisement, but it's not clear that it's available in a judicial foreclosure. Minnesota has a robust foreclosure prevention program, and housing counselors have asked legal aid whether they can advise clients that they may use the postponement tool in judicial foreclosures. The language before you simply clarifies that Minnesota's right to postpone a sale, either by a mortgagor or a mortgagee, is available in a judicial foreclosure. We've worked with and would like to thank the Minnesota State Bar Association's Real Property Section, the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Association, Bank Inn, and the Minnesota Land Title Association. All of those stakeholders have been consulted and none have concerns about the bill. And we'd like to thank the Minnesota Mortgage Association for its assistance, and there's a letter of support from them in your packets. I ask for your support, and with me to testify is Ron Elwood from Legal Aid.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and Chair Liebling and Chair Scott. Just want to say thank you to Representative Freiberg for bringing the bill and echo his thanks to all the stakeholders who work with us to get to where we are, and happy to answer any technical questions that you may have on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. Is there member discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I'm just curious what percentage of foreclosures are done via action versus sheriff's sale. You said it's increasing since the court case. You can want to take a stab at that or not?
Mr. Elwood.
Well, Madam Chair, Madam Chairs, Madam's Chairs. I don't know what percentage. I can just tell you that commercial foreclosures are, I think, almost always by action, judicial foreclosure. Up until this decision, almost all of the residential foreclosures were by advertisement.
Right.
And what we've seen is just an uptick. The percentage, I can't tell you, but it was this decision was in 2022, and since then, more foreclosures. They're coming more to the housing counselors. These judicial foreclosures for homeowners are coming for help on and they're going to judicial foreclosure. And the issue is, you know, this was a great tool. It's worked. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes it. It doesn't change the goalposts. It just moves the redemption period to the end to give people more time to come up with the money they owe instead of having to come up with the entire amount of the remaining mortgage. And it gives people a better opportunity to save their home or sell the home and take out whatever equity they can. And so it's a great tool. It's worked. It's just to make sure that we can use it in all instances for the same purposes. So I think I danced around your question enough, but I don't think I answered it.
It's okay. I wouldn't expect you to have that data precisely, but that gives me a clear picture. Thank you.
All right. Other questions or discussion? All right. Seeing none, any closing words, Representative Freiberg?
No, I appreciate your consideration. I know you have a full agenda, so I'll leave it brief. I thank you and ask for your support for the bill.
All right, so I will renew my motion that House File 1224, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way. Thank you. Next, we will take up House File 1836, Representative Cleavorn. And the chair will move that House File 1836 be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. And there is an A1 amendment. And Chair Cleavorn, did you want to take that up right away?
Yes, please, if we could get the bill in the order that we would like it.
All right, so I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it.
Okay.
Any discussion? All in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much. And I would just like to thank the chairs for hearing the bill. And also I would like to thank you both for the time that you gave me to offer or consider input to the bill as well. So House File 1836 relates to the Government Data Practices Act, which is in Chapter 13, which allows an individual to challenge the accuracy or completeness of data that a government entity has about them. To the specific bill itself, the background is that we want to make sure that individuals who have the right to challenge the information that a government entity has about them that is to be complete, sorry, to correct it if it is inaccurate or incomplete, and those challenges can be appealed to the Commissioner of Administration. The bill proposes to update the data challenge process in the following ways. First, it allows not public data to be shared between agencies to facilitate appeals, which is very important. And currently, data challenged in appeal is to be assumed public, but the government entities may need to submit private data in order to facilitate these appeals. Second, it keeps inaccurate or incomplete data private at the Department of Administration. And this ensures that private data stays private during the data challenge appeals process. It prevents further dissemination of incorrect or incomplete data, and that challenge data that are determined to be accurate or complete will remain public. And with me, I have the Department of Administration. If members have questions, they would be happy to answer.
All right. Thank you very much. Did you want to testify or just for questions?
I can just be here for questions.
All right. Thank you. All right. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anybody. So members, questions, comments? All right. Not seeing any. So I, Chair Scott, did you want to? Okay. All right. Chair Cleaborn, do you want to make a closing comment?
Thank you. This is an important bill, and it helps everyone in our state make sure that we have accurate and complete information. I ask for your support to move this bill to state government. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So I will renew my motion that House File 1836, as amended, be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, next we have House File 1367, Chair Pinto, and the Chair, I will move to that House File 1367 be re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee, and there is an A1 amendment. And Chair Pinto, do you want to start by with that amendment? Do you want us to move that amendment?
That would be great, Madam Chair, if you can. Yeah, just does some cleanup.
Okay. So I will move the A1 amendment, and if you would like to, okay, you just described it that it does some cleanup. Do you want us to adopt that, and then we'll discuss the bill as amended?
I would, Madam Chair, if you can. Yeah.
All right. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, members. There is a good summary of the bill that should be, I believe, is in the packet under the heading of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I work as an assistant county attorney in Ramsey County. The bill is brought to me by the MCAA, and it expands maltreatment protections to children in the care of others while traveling to other states and countries. So there's a gap that the MCAA identified in our maltreatment protections when a child who's a Minnesota resident experiences abuse or maltreatment when traveling to another place. I've got an expert here with me who can provide some more detail, but that is the gist of the bill, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And I just would say MCAA is Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Correct, Madam Chair. Yeah, that is exactly right.
All right, thank you, because I know I didn't know that when I first encountered it. All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Jackson. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney. Today I'm also here as a representative of the Minnesota County Attorney Association and the Minnesota County Attorney Association's Juvenile Law Committee. The bill before you this morning is a priority for the Minnesota County Attorney Association this year. We've been working on this bill for 2 years. It provides a technical change to correct an omission regarding subject matter jurisdiction for local responsible social service agencies to investigate maltreatment matters. The attorneys practicing in this area, like myself, who represent local responsible social service agencies, bring this bill forward to fill that jurisdictional gap. The intent of the bill is to protect children who are maltreated outside of Minnesota, but who reside within our Minnesota borders. This bill is also supported with the assistance of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. The bill aims to protect Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens. It may be best to share a scenario that prompted my office and the Minnesota County Attorney Association to bring this legislation forward. In Minnesota, in Dakota County, a family traveled to Florida for vacation. While they were in Florida, the offender, who was the stepfather in the home and who is also a minister, sexually abused the child. The family returned to Minnesota, and the allegations of those sexual abuse were reported to the local police department and Dakota County Social Services. No action regarding the child protection allegations were taken in Florida by Child Protection, and Florida ultimately declined to criminally prosecute the matter. However, Dakota County Social Services accepted the report, screened it in, investigated it, and upheld a maltreatment determination against the father. The stepfather appealed the maltreatment determination to Department of Human Services, and ultimately the human service judge reversed Dakota County Social Services' finding of maltreatment for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because the sexual abuse occurred beyond Minnesota border. Dakota County was also prevented from appealing the reversal to the district court because the statutory language indicated that the appeal could only be taken in the district court in the county where the maltreatment occurred. This situation is not unique and isolated to Dakota County. The resulting opinion from the human service judge had this excerpt in its analysis and conclusion. This analysis may seem overly technical in view of the fact that appellant and the child lived in Minnesota at all times and the alleged maltreatment was reported to the agency. It is also recognized that this potentially puts some Minnesota children in a more vulnerable position simply because the alleged conduct occurred in another state. Unfortunately, overcoming the presumption against extraterritorial application requires a clear expression of contrary legislative intent. These considerations might be good arguments for changing the law to include such an expression of intent in circumstances like these, but is not something we can accomplish here. At this point in time, we are asking that the committee protect these maltreatments, the victims of these maltreatments. It is a public policy of the state of Minnesota to protect children, and it is the intent of the legislature to protect children and provide protective services. We are asking that the statute be expanded so that the current law that fails to protect Minnesota children who travel beyond our state's borders can be protected under this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone, you have no other testifiers, correct?
No, okay. Madam Chair.
Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone, so open for member questions. Representative Steer.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. So I've expressed some heartburn over this just based on the framework that's involved in this bill. There's just so many moving parts here. I'm wondering, is there any other state in the country that has a similar bill to this?
Much.
Ms. Jackson.
Thank you. Representative Steer, I'm not aware. I don't know that answer. I'm sorry.
Good. Representative Steer.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. So when the counties I talk to are also worried about, there's a backlog of child protection cases right now, and this would be very costly to do, although it's a very noble thing to do, and we probably should do it. I just think that the scope that we're looking for is so broad, there's so many moving parts here, that I think we need to narrow this down to what exactly we're looking to do. The question would be, is there any appropriation of money going back to the counties to help fund a case that would start in, say, Lee Seward County and the allegation was in Florida, for example? travel costs, witnesses, things like that. Is there any appropriation of money that for the counties?
Ms. Jackson? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'll take the first cut at that, Representative Stewart, and see what the testifier has to say. I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about a pretty limited set of circumstances, right? This is something where there's a Minnesota resident, a child who then experiences abuse or molestation outside of Minnesota, so pretty small set of cases. I don't think there's no requirement. I mean, the investigating agency doesn't necessarily have to do any particular thing itself. It can partner with those who are in those locations. So no, the bill itself does not contain an appropriation. And again, I think it's a pretty limited set of circumstances, but it is one, to your point, that we would absolutely want to make sure, even if there's a backlog of other cases, if there's a child who's sexually abused and is back at home with their abuser, that's something that our counties really should care about, and I think do care about. Right now, if they care about it, the law doesn't let them do anything about it. And that seems like a real problem that needs to be solved by this. But my testifier may have more to add.
Anything more on that?
Thank you. Representative Sear, there are already counties that are assessing these maltreatment determinations only to find out that they are making the maltreatment determination. It gets appealed to a human service judge, and it is dismissed or reversed for lack of jurisdiction. So a lot of these cases are already being assessed by the child protection agencies. There are also the ability, as Representative Pinto indicated, that we can share those responsibilities. We can ask for courtesy supervision. We can ask for courtesy interviews. When the child does reside in Minnesota, even though they did travel out of state or the country, they are back in Minnesota. They are back in Minnesota with the caregiver or the offender. They are back in a local area, so we are able to interview them face-to-face in Minnesota. So those are obligations of the agency to investigate and interview the victim and the alleged perpetrator, and that can be done locally.
Representative Stier.
Sorry, I had to get a drink there. So it's my understanding that there's a civil track, which would be child protection, and then a law enforcement track that would investigate the case. So these cases aren't going unchecked. Law enforcement is still working with the other state to look for criminal penalties. So I think it's already being done on the law enforcement side, where we can still bring criminal charges in a different state. We just have to work with that state. Say Florida, for example, we would send information to Florida. We would work the investigation from Minnesota, and they could charge it out in Florida where it happened. And then it would still be marked on the criminal history as being charged, and that would flag it for any other, like applying for a job. For example, he would be or she would be charged with this misconduct in a different state, so it would still show up on a criminal history. So I do think that we're hitting it on the law enforcement side. I just don't know if – I just think, again, I think the heartburn I have is that this is so broad. It's just we're not focused on a one particular thing. Like you want to – we talked earlier, you want to be able to screen in the report so you can investigate it. I think that's very, very – narrow, and I can get on board with that. There's just so much other stuff packed into this that I just can't get behind. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stier, I actually feel like that's a good, if you think about it the opposite way, you know, you talked about Minnesota law enforcement investigating, but if it's a crime that occurred in Florida, Minnesota law enforcement has no jurisdiction, right? There's no ability to pursue that criminally, but, I would imagine that if it happens in Florida and the child lives in your community, the Florida investigator for the crime that occurred in Florida may well call you up and say, could you conduct an interview for me, right? So the Florida investigator isn't having to travel to Minnesota to investigate the crime. Criminal jurisdiction is based on where the act occurred. It occurred in Florida. So you as a Minnesota law enforcement officer have no jurisdiction over that, but you can cooperate. In the same way, child protection jurisdiction, we want to make sure that it's where the child resides because that's this ongoing concern. And right now, that's what this bill would fix because the law does not allow that to be pursued.
Representative Stier.
So I guess that's my concern is that, you know, we don't have any jurisdiction for law enforcement, and you're asking for just jurisdiction in the civil portion, the child protection portion, and no other state has what we have right now. So do they have to comply with that? I mean, we're asking for something that's brand new in the country. I just don't know if it's been vetted enough. I don't know if we checked with other states to see, would you do this? I mean, is this okay to do? Laws are not the same across the country. So if a crime occurred in Florida that's not illegal in Minnesota, so it's not illegal in Florida, but it's illegal in Minnesota, are they going to help with the investigation? I guess that's my question. It's moving parts.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll say that I think abuse and molestation of the kind we're talking about are illegal in every state. One would hope if we come across one that's not, please let us know and let's make sure that those lawmakers are aware of that. Yeah, so in any case, I know what I was going to say. We don't know that this is not in place in other states. It's just, it's not something that we had researched. I'd be very surprised if there are not other states that have it. I would say it seems really illogical, right, that our child protection should be able to take action to protect the residents, the child residents of their communities.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Pinto, for this. You actually answered one of my questions, is whether or not we're going to give law enforcement the ability to investigate crimes outside our state boundaries as well. So there's a concern of mine that we're allowing other entities, other agencies to be stepping outside that jurisdiction and kind of investigating crimes that occurred in a different spot as well, which is one of my concerns. The evidence collection here, who's going to be doing these investigations, and is there going to be any type of evidence collection here? Are we going to be working with different agencies here? And can you speak on that a little bit for me, please?
Representative Duran.
Ms. Jackson.
I'm sorry. Representative Duran. It would depend on the circumstances. We don't know the level of the evidence that is accumulated. When a child protection report is received, it is cross-reported to law enforcement, and if law enforcement receives that child protection report, it is cross-reported to the local agency. You do your own independent investigations and ultimately make your own findings, but you can share information with each other. So there is the ability to share information if someone on the law enforcement side or the child protection side is gathering evidence, information, interviews. That can be shared. When it is across borders, as was already stated, we can ask for courtesy interviews. We can ask for help. Those investigations can be done jointly with law enforcement and social services, but I would like to point out that this bill only deals with the child protection side, the social service side. This does not impact the law enforcement agency's ability to investigate crimes. We are talking about the ability for Minnesota to protect Minnesota's kids who reside here in Minnesota to make sure to determine whether maltreatment was determined and whether services are needed for that child. Those are the two determinations that the agency has to make when they conduct an investigation. The fact that something occurs to a child who is outside of our state on a vacation, on an extended visit with a family member or a non-custodial parent, and they come back to Minnesota, we want to be able to make sure we can assess their safety and we can see if they need any other services. That is the intent of this bill, is to allow us to serve our Minnesota children, even if they were harmed outside the state, but they do reside here.
All right. Representative Duran, final question, because we're going to move this to a vote pretty soon. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a concern of mine as well. Like, what is going on right now that we're missing the boat here? Because don't we have intakes that handle this stuff and then we pass it off to the other states if there's nothing? I mean, don't we take care of the children right now anyways? I'm a little concerned on this.
Maybe Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Duran, I guess I'd urge you to take a look at the packet, because, I mean, the short answer is no under the law as it is right now. These are cases where child protection investigated. A child was found to have been, in the case of Dakota County, found to have been molested, and the law does not allow the county to then step in with child protection, actually protect that child to ensure that child doesn't continue being molested by the person who did the molestation. So I think the short answer is that no, that's why this bill is being brought forward.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And obviously we want all of our kids to be protected, and if something like this happens, we want the kid to get the resources they need, and we want the perpetrator to be held accountable. I'm just curious about the authority that our DHS that's doing the investigation has in another state. And constitutionally, does that pass muster? those are just some of my concerns about the bill. So I don't know if that, if Representative Pinto, if you have an answer for that, or
Or maybe, I don't know if Mr. Hopkins, if you're the right person, or
Ms. Davis,
please.
Chair and members, Mary Davis from the House Research Department. I think the issue you're kind of looking at here is that is for like civil jurisdiction in child protection matters. So the parties reside here and they live in Minnesota. Their contacts are here, their connections are here. So there is civil jurisdiction for cases related to child protection and child maltreatment. I think that there's a clear nexus and there isn't really an issue with civil jurisdiction related to child protection matters occurring in Minnesota with Minnesota residents.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you. So would this at any point, in the example you gave with Florida, would this compel anyone in Florida to comply with Minnesota law?
Ms. Jackson, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't think that it would, but I'll note that right now there is no compulsion, right? What this does, this at least authorizes Minnesota to take action. And so hopefully there's the collaboration and cooperation. But there's no, Minnesota may not be able to force compliance, but right now we're blocked by not even being able to take action ourselves. And one would hope that in most cases states would participate and be cooperative when a child has been alleged to be molested or abused in their state. Either way, though, right now we're prevented from taking action in Minnesota.
All right. This is still kind of murky to me, Madam Chair. But.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Scott. Thank you, Representative Pinto. We're kind of running out of time here, but I just would say to members, it's been a good discussion. Thank you for raising questions. Remember, this is going to another committee. There's time to talk with Representative Pinto offline if you still have concerns. But I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1367, as amended, be re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. I'm going to move along here. Okay. So we're going to take up House File 1168, Representative Bonner. And I'm going to move that House File 1168 be re-referred to the Tax Committee. And Representative Bonner, go ahead. And I don't see an amendment, right?
Okay. There is no amendment.
All right. So Representative Bonner, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You may notice this bill from before. It was heard here again last year. It did pass through both chambers last year, made it into the tax bill, and slipped through the cracks at the last minute, but it does enjoy support in both chambers. This bill has already had the language heard in the Elections Committee as well, where it passed out with universal approval. As you may know, Minnesotans participate in elections at higher rates than any other state. We're proud to consistently claim the top spot for the highest participation in the country. Last session, we made historic changes to reduce the influence of big money interests in corporations and our political process to favor small donors. A big part of that is the Political Contribution Refund Program. The state works in concert here with the Campaign Finance Board and the Minnesota Department of Revenue to make these refunds available to all citizens. Today, the process is highly manual and almost exclusively done via paper. This bill modernizes this widely successful program, allowing Minnesotans across the political spectrum to file refunds electronically, making it easier, faster, streamlining the process, and bringing the refund program into the digital age. The proposal before you utilizes the enhanced CFB reporting systems to generate electronic receipts with unique identifiers for each transaction, allowing receipts and refunds to be verified for traceability. Party units and candidates then furnish that receipt via paper or electronic means, allowing the contributor to apply for the refund directly through the Minnesota Department of Revenue's website. The provisions pertinent to this committee include the data provisions in Section 1 on data classification. This was amended in this committee last session based on mutual agreement with Chair Scott. Thank you for that. And classifies the data as non-public data. And then in Section 2 on the penalties for violations, it indicates candidates and committees may not issue receipts without being eligible to participate in the PCR program, and you may not issue a refund to an individual that is not eligible. It creates a penalty and a misdemeanor offense for violation. In the House, this bill does enjoy bipartisan support in both chambers. And with that, I would ask your support to bring Minnesota's PCR program into the modern era. You will note in your packets you do have a written testimony from the treasurer of CD3, and I do have one testifier here today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Co-Chair Liebling and Co-Chair Scott. And members of the committee, my name is David Fisher. I'm a volunteer advisor with Clean Elections Minnesota, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working for a healthy democracy. I'm a lawyer. I'm a law professor at the University of Minnesota and a former commissioner of administration responsible for interpretation and application of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. We are here to strongly support House File 1168 to finally modernize the state's political contribution refund program, and we thank Representative Bonner for bringing this forward. It would authorize the sharing of data between the Department of Revenue and the Campaign Finance Board in order to establish an online system for citizens to claim political contribution refunds, classifying this data as non-public or private data. A Pew Research study from the fall of 2023 found that Americans feel major donors have too much influence in our elections. Large majorities across party lines say that big campaign donors and special interests have an outsized influence on policy decisions, while people in individual voting districts, by contrast, are widely viewed as having too little influence. Updating the public financing program provides an opportunity to broaden public engagement in democracy and amplify the voices of ordinary Minnesotans in the electoral process. Modernized public financing programs, such as an online donor refund program, empower individuals to make meaningful contributions to candidates they support and enhance voters' ability to participate in electoral campaigns. What we know about this modernization plan will make it easier for voters to use and make them more engaged in the political process, make candidates less dependent on big donors and more accountable to voters, and increase the number of candidates who participate in the public finance program and agree to campaign spending limits. Clean Elections Minnesota submits that although these programs cannot squeeze private money out of politics, well-designed and enhanced online programs will increase the importance of small donors to candidates and increase participation by an economically and geographically more representative group of citizens. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, this is the most powerful reform available to counter the outsized influence of the wealthy and corporations. Clean Elections Minnesota urges the House Judiciary and Civil Law Committee to vote to advance House File 1168. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So let's see. I don't think there are any other testifiers signed up. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, member questions, discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner. I think I understand how this works, but just to get it on the record, can you kind of walk us through, or your testifier walk us through, what the user experience is going to be like in terms of the contributor, the treasurer, the campaign finance board, how this is going to differ from the current process?
And Representative Bonner, I'll let you respond. I just want to point out, though, that we're short on time and this jurisdiction of this committee is limited. So go ahead.
Yeah. I'll try to be really brief. Basically, right now the system does generate a unique identifier for each transaction in the system as it is. So what this would do is then allow us to generate that electronic receipt. You can send it to your contributor either electronically, or you can print it out and send a paper copy for folks who need it. But what it would then allow is that that individual, once they have either the paper or the electronic receipt from your treasurer, to go ahead and go to the website and directly enter their information in order to receive the refund. So no more having to fill out the paper form, put it in the mail. You certainly can do that, but in this case, it could create pretty strong efficiencies by being able to do that online. It would also speed up the time to get back that receipt or that refund. So it just really makes it a little bit easier to follow and a little less kludgy with the papers and the forms. You can still do that under this, however, this makes it a little bit more efficient. We also expect that in the first year of rolling it out, it will save about $15,000 and about $3,000 in paper processing each year after.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Okay, other questions? All right, seeing none, then I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1168 be re-referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. So we're switching the order a little bit. Okay, so we're going to call up next House File 1999, Representative Green. And so I will move that House File 1999 be re-referred to, let's see, where are we going? Oh, yes. Okay, we're going to lay this bill over. So I'm going to move House File 1999 to bring it before the committee. And there are a couple of amendments. And I think, Representative Green, you wanted to move the amendments as we get going here. Am I right?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. I was just passing some treats. Okay. Since this is my first.
And you wanted to move your amendments?
Yes, I would like to move Amendment 1 first.
Okay. And so let's just move these amendments and get them on the bill to get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it, if that's okay with everybody. So I will move the A1 amendment any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the and then I will move the A2 amendment. Discussion. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And so, members, just a word on that. If it's something substantive, of course, we'll have it described and explained and all of that before we vote on it. But it's kind of customary to let the an author get the bill in the shape they want it to, in order to have it discussed, especially in the first committee in which it's appearing, which I believe this is. Am I right, Representative Green? So. Okay, so please go ahead and present your bill as amended, and if you could just make note of what we just did with your two amendments, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair, so much. And I just want to thank both chairs for hearing this bill, and I appreciate Chair Scott for our conversation about this bill that we had on the floor and the feedback that you provided. So for background, I am a former school board member myself, and so I've had a front row seat to this issue for many years. I'm going to walk us through kind of what this bill means. So it's going to sound a little bit elementary, but I just want to make sure everyone understands what we're talking about. So many Minnesota school districts are experiencing an influx of data requests in recent years. And so what does a data request look like in public schools? So let's say Mr. Winbird wants to know more about the training that teachers are required to complete every year. Mr. Winbird has that right under the Minnesota Data Practices Act to ask the district for that data, and then the school district under an open government, as an open government entity, has the obligation to provide that data for him to inspect. Now, if Mr. Winberg wanted physical copies of this data after he inspected it, the school district could charge him a fee in providing it. Mr. Winberg also had the choice to ask for this data anonymously. So where's the issue? I'm glad you asked. This increase in demand for data requests that the public has every right to make, no matter what the topic is also putting a strain on school resources. It takes staff time to respond and prepare the data, and it's extra challenging if they are large in scale, non-specific, or need redacting of personal data. Now here's the nuance, and the purpose of H-File 1999 is to address what I call non-serious requests. And here's what I mean by that. One of our metro area districts received a data request from a nondescript email address, anonymous. The district did their job, prepared the data for anonymous for inspection, but then the data just sat. No one came to inspect it. The cost? $6,000 in district staff time. They reported four of these non-serious request incidents this past year. Another example from a smaller rural district, request comes in, district carries out their due diligence, prepares the data, and again, nothing. The unknown source never showed up to inspect the data. Cost to the district, $7,000 in staff time. So non-serious requests waste taxpayer dollars and resources, and they really also frustrate legitimate requests, hindering districts' ability to quickly fulfill timely requests for media and others that are more serious. So what does this bill do? House File 1999 is the middle ground between open government and accountability. If a request is made anonymously and then not collected for inspection, the requester is then responsible for the cost of that request, holding school districts harmless. Giving districts the ability to communicate this law as an expectation with anonymous requesters should really help deter non-serious requesters. The abandonment of uninspected data by unknown individuals is something districts cannot afford. I want to thank all the testifiers that you'll hear from today. I've spoken with them all. We've had a valuable exchange of ideas on this issue. There's also a commitment for collaboration to find solutions for school districts within current law to help better manage data requests more broadly, and I look forward to that work. And I have some testifiers here.
All right, thank you, Representative Green. So, please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Oh, you know what, Chair, can we go to Jeff Elstead, our online testifier first?
Oh, yes, we certainly can.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Elstead. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Will do. Good morning, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Elstead, the proud superintendent for the Owatonna Public Schools. And I'm here this morning to help support the efforts of Representative Green in House File 1999. Over the past 2 years, we have received 12 anonymous requests for data. Out of that 12, I would indicate to you that 9 of them became abandoned and cost our district in excess of $40,000 to prepare and redact the documents that were necessary. Out of that $40,000, approximately $30,000 of those were abandoned, and no one ever came to look at the data. It was requested. This causes our department here as a district of what I would call medium size in the state of Minnesota. It does put an onerous responsibility on our human resources department, as well as some of our secretarial staff in gathering up some of that data. I would also gather, this is my opportunity to let you know, that data requests in our school district over the course of the past 4 years have cost our taxpayers in excess of $400,000 for those data requests to come in. If we compute that into FTE, that's approximately 4 full-time teachers for our school district that we were not able to hire or had to reduce our budget in order to accomplish these data requests. So again, I'm a big supporter of this. I'm a supporter of also the transparency that school districts do have with all of our constituents. We just want to make sure that those constituent asks are responsible in nature and that we provide them so that the data is indeed collected and done appropriately. So again, I appreciate the time to testify this morning and the opportunity for this committee to hear this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Elstead. Really appreciate your testimony today. Let's turn to Mr. Carlson. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Co-Chair Liebling and representatives. Thank you for having me here today. My name is John Carlson. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer at Rochester Public Schools. Rochester is a growing community. We have 17,000 kids and we employ more than 3,000 adults. In one area of our staffing plan, we have had to grow our costs recently, and that's regretfully in the data request response team. We've added a new position that costs about $100,000 per year, so it's an ongoing expense to deal with the dozens upon dozens of data requests we continue to get. And this comes just as Superintendent Elstead has said, we're also needing to reduce teachers from time to time. I want to boil it down to three main things we are seeing. First, we are having many good narrow data requests that help provide transparency to an operational or a financial situation, whether it be around a contract or a specific payment. All in all, the data requests are written very well, and we're happy to respond to them. Second, we're getting commercialized data requests where vendors are coming in and they're wanting our data on every purchase we make so they can data mine that and resell that for a profit. Maybe there's some value that serves the greater good if someone analyzes what schools are paying for lunchroom napkins and pieces of paper, but Rochester Public Schools is not experiencing any benefit from that, from what we can tell. And then third, kind of on the same topic, we are having some of these anonymous phishing expeditions where we are getting broad, hard to interpret, and sometimes anonymous focused data requests on all emails, all electronic files. They want us to look in textbooks, pieces of paper, all for a certain word or a certain topic. These data requests can take weeks or months to fulfill, and it may be for nothing if the request was made anonymously for inspection, and then that anonymous person does not show up to inspect the data, which has happened. In most of our data requests, it's not just our manager now who's working on these. It involves other staff like myself. It requires leaders and lawyers to look and make sure that we also are redacting appropriate non-public information. So I want to commend you for taking this up and for Representative Green for putting this on the table. One thing I do want to just comment on the anonymous piece. We are concerned in our district that if we don't have a way to identify the anonymous person, for example, we had a data request that we calculated out every teacher, every principal would need to come in on a Saturday, spend a couple of hours of time, and it was going to add up to about $901,000 of time. We're going to need to pay in stipends for this extra overtime. So if we don't know how to get a hold of the people or get some sort of payment in advance, that is our main concern. And so we do wish to see some more teeth around that issue. So thank you for taking the time to hear my concerns.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have a couple of public testifiers, Mr. Gemberling and Mr. Neumeister. So why don't we take their testimony? And just please, if you could please be brief. And this bill is going to be laid over, so it's not going anywhere today. But let's, if you want to come up to the podium. And just to note, too, I think Mr. Neumeister, I know, submitted written testimony, and that's in your packet. Members, I would encourage you to read the testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, co-chairs Liebling and Scott. My name is Don Gemberling. I've been here before, so I'm not going to say a lot about me. I will only add something important to this discussion. There's nobody in this room who has taught more school districts on how to comply with the Data Practices Act than me, okay? And I know that for a certainty. And I have the records to prove it if you need them. So with that introduction, I want to thank Representative Green, okay? She's been very helpful to this discussion. She's one of the best listeners in the legislature I've ever encountered, and thank you very much for what you're trying to do. Okay? So, the Minnesota Coalition of Government Information, of which I'm a spokesperson, essentially tries to make sure that government information is as open as possible to the public. Okay? And so we look at legislation, that's part of what we do, and you know, we're very careful when something comes in that tries to limit what's happening under the Data Practices Act. And this bill does have that effect, okay? I understand the anonymous, the ability to reach, make anonymous requests is gonna stay in the bill, and we appreciate, or gonna stay in the law, and we appreciate that, okay? Anonymous requests are one of the things that levels the playing field between the government and citizens, because citizens are sometimes reluctant to make identifiable requests because, frankly, they fear retaliation. One of the things I used to do and still do is talk to citizens trying to get information out of the government. And I would often say to them, well, you know, you could go and get blah, blah, blah. And they say, you know, if they know who I am, they're going to somehow retaliate me. The saddest ones of those stories were people who said they're going to retaliate against my children, okay, because I have kids in school. So, and those just really bothered me. I'm a product of public schools. So let's talk about
Mr. Gemberling, I'm afraid it's been 2 minutes. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up, please.
You're kidding.
I am not kidding. Please wrap up.
Okay. I think, and Representative Green and I have discussed this, there's a series of larger issues here which somebody ought to carefully take the time to look at, okay? And I strongly suggest you do so. We will continue to work with Representative Green to do so. And I, frankly, what you just said really frustrated me.
Well, I'm sorry.
One of the roles I played consistently for years was to help legislators understand these issues.
Mr. Gemberling,
turning down that
Mr. Gemberling, thank you. We're laying the bill over. There will be further discussion. Mr. Neumeister, did you wish to testify?
Thank you, anyway.
Thank you. Welcome. Welcome to the committee.
If you can give me at least a 15-second notice, I'd be obliged to you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I echo that same as I was saying. I emphasize her open regard to listen. So thank you, Representative Green. My comments are very specific. You've got to understand that over 50 years, government has become more intertwined with our lives, where they make decisions about us. And when that happens to us, we, the public, want to ask why, how come, and all that. That's why there are more data requests than ever before, because there's more involvement of government within our lives. Secondly, I am glad that Representative Green took the ID thing out. As you know, I oppose even the way the bill is now because of all the other kinds of issues that I articulate in my testimony. I think it is important to understand that school districts, Mr. Gemberling and I get many calls from parents, even some news media, in trying to get involved, how to get information about their children and all that. It's frustrating. But most of the time when they talk with Mr. Gemberling or I, they do get their data. Finally, there is flexibility in the law to address the anonymous request. That's where, as Representative Green indicated, more discussion, how you train, and also how you comply with data management can ease what I heard being said by the former testifiers today. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you got my 2 cents plus a page and a half. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Neumeister. And thank you to you and Mr. Gemberling for working with Representative Green. And thank you, Representative Green, for your work on this bill, because this is obviously a very important problem. And we're all about solving problems here. So thank you. With that, I'm going to lay the bill over. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for being here. And the bill is laid over. Oh, yeah, and as Chair Scott reminds me, if the bill comes back up, we will have a discussion on it. So I'm not cutting off discussion, but we need to move on today. We obviously won't move the bill without further consideration. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we are going to go now to House File 2127. We're going to change the order a little bit here just because we have testifiers who need to leave. So, and we're running a little bit behind. So we're going to take up House File 2127, Representative Curran. Curran. Representative Curran. Representative Curran is going to move House File 2127 to get it before the committee. And let's see. We are, and this bill as well, we're going to lay over today. So there is an A1 amendment. And Representative Curran, did you want to move the A1?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move the A1.
Do you want to give us just a brief explanation of what that is doing?
Yes, I can. There's also a summary of the amendment in members' packets, but it's essentially work. The amendment incorporates work that's been done in stakeholder work groups, lots of technical changes, clarifying language, and, I mean, ultimately it's to get it into the shape that we believe is workable.
Okay. So, Did you want to move that first, I assume, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Representative Curran moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which they would like to have it heard. So all in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Curran, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. I will be brief in my introduction, but you do have in your packets a pretty extensive history of when the initial bill passed in 2024 to offer judicial officials and staff protections when it comes to their data privacy. We passed that bill in 2024. I'm just going to mention a couple of things before I turn it over. One, when that bill was introduced and discussed in 2024, members of both parties had concerns about who was covered under this bill and who wasn't. And I just want to sort of frame this conversation in the context of this is a fix that specifically applies to what was passed. And so bills or ideas that would limit or narrow down who this applies to or extend this protection to other groups of people would be other bills that are being discussed. So we're trying to limit it just to this bill in front of us that would apply to the law that was passed. I think the other thing that I just wanted to mention is that when we were discussing this bill last session, we were very well aware that there were going to be there was ongoing work that needed to be done regarding some really tricky data practices out there and different data that that exists out there. So we fully expected to come back this year specifically with a bill that tackled the issue of property records, and so that's what we're here discussing today. And I'll turn it over to testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Curran. So we're going to have first take Chief Judge Schlitz, because I think Schultz. I'm sorry.
The I is before
wrong.
The L.
Oh, okay.
You're the first one who's ever mispronounced my name.
Well, I think I'm just reading it off my script, so sorry. I don't know. Maybe it's
I'm
not
just
here. But, yeah, I better not do that in court, huh? Yeah. So anyway, please go ahead. I know you have a tight timeline here.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for letting me move up my testimony. If you read the newspapers, as I'm sure you all do, you'll know that the federal courts are really busy right now, and our court in particular is really busy, and I have to get back to the courthouse by noon. So thank you. As many of you probably know, the number of threats against federal judges has increased dramatically in recent years, and most of those making these threats have been using our personal information, the information of judges and their family members that is easily available online. And that is why we judges are grateful for the judicial security legislation that you passed last year. It was a critical first step in protecting the safety and security of those of us who serve our state and our country in the judicial branch. Unfortunately, though, the bill passed last year had a huge loophole. It failed to protect the property records of judges, even though property records are by far the most common reason why our home addresses are easily available on the internet. When we are at the courthouse, we are safe. In our federal courthouses, for example, we have armed guards who screen everybody who come into the courthouse. And they do a good job. At home, though, we are vulnerable. And it's no coincidence that every attack that has occurred against a federal judge or a member of a judge's family has been at the judge's home. Consider just a few quick examples of recent attacks on judges. A little over a year ago, Washington County, Maryland Judge Andrew Wilkinson was killed at his home by a disgruntled litigant. Investigators later discovered that the killer had searched the internet for information about Judge Wilkinson, whose home address was readily available. In 2022, retired Juneau County, Wisconsin Judge John Romer was zip-tied to a chair, tortured and killed in his home by a disgruntled litigant, someone he had sentenced to prison years earlier. In 2020, the 20-year-old son of my friend, federal judge Esther Salas of New Jersey, was killed, and her husband was critically wounded at their home by a disgruntled attorney dressed as a Federal Express delivery person who was trying to kill Judge Salas and who'd found her home address on the internet. In 2005, a disgruntled litigant went to the home of federal judge Joan Lefkow of Illinois, intending to kill her. She happened not to be home, so he killed her husband and her mother instead. In 1989, circuit judge Robert Vance of Alabama was killed at his kitchen table when he opened a package that had been mailed to him. It was a mail bomb that had been mailed by a disgruntled litigant. In 1988, Judge Richard Duranko of New York was killed at his home while he was tending his garden by the father of a disgruntled pro se litigant. And finally, in 1979, federal judge John Wood of Texas was killed outside his home by a contract killer who had been hired by a drug trafficker who was awaiting trial before the judge. I should note that in the almost 200-year history of the United States, before Judge Wood's assassination, a total of one federal judge had been killed. One. In a duel with a political rival in New Mexico Territory in 1867. That's how our world has changed in recent years. Putting aside the duel, the common thread that runs through every single attack that has been made on a federal judge or a family member is that the attack occurred at the judge's home. The law that you passed last year to protect our personal information was well intended, but omitting our property records from the law created a giant loophole that essentially defeated the purpose of the law. If we judges could come before you and ask that just one category of information be protected, one and only one, it would be our home addresses. And yet that's the one part of it's the one category of information that wasn't protected by the bill that you enacted last year. So I urge you to approve the amendment that is pending before you, close this loophole, and protect the property records of judges and their family members. This amendment represents the work of many stakeholders, including federal and state judges and the Federal Bar Association, who came together to propose a way to close the loophole without unduly disrupting the important work of the other parts of the government. We very much appreciate the work you've done to protect us so far and your interest in strengthening and making more effective that protection. Thank you for giving me the chance to testify, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to give offense, but I've got to run back to the court.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate that you were able to be here. Okay, and we have one other testifier, and I'm going to ask you to please be as brief as you can. And please go ahead.
Introduce yourself. Thank you. My name is Todd Shuffleman. I'm a judge in the 10th Judicial District, chambered in Anoka County. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association and the Minnesota Judicial Branch. Before I was on the bench, I also was a prosecutor, and I worked for Sherburne County, so I did do some real estate work. So I am familiar with some of the issues we had to deal with when addressing what happened with last year. First of all, thank you. Thank you so much for passing the bill last year. You recognize the issues we're dealing with, and what we just heard from Chief Judge expresses just how much of a problem there is out there. The threats are getting worse. The environment is getting worse. Now we're dealing with things such as drones, and a judge told me last year at our conference, when you go up in front of the committee, make sure you let them know we're dealing with people with drones over judges' homes now. So If you're watching, Judge, you know who I'm talking about. I told the committee. Also, swatting. Up until a little while ago, I had no idea what that term meant. I'm seeing heads nod so people know what I'm talking about. That, of course, only works if you know the home address. If you don't know the home address, swatting is of no use to you. We passed the bill last year, again, with the thanks of everyone here, but we simply couldn't solve the real estate exception, I'll call it. It was just too complex to resolve at the end of the term last year. So we set up a work group with the idea of, we know we have to balance safety with, we need to have a smooth real estate market, because selfishly, when it comes time to retire, I want to be able to sell my house as efficiently as possible. In order for that to work, certain data needs to move regardless of if it's private or not. So we set up the Judicial Safety Real Estate Work Group. We met about 15 times between large group and small group, and that also includes some other meetings outside of just those groups. It included members of the judiciary, land title professionals, real estate professionals, county representatives, federal officials, and attorneys. We also had discussions with MNCOGI, MNCLU, the Newspaper Association, and I believe Mr. Neumeister also had some conversations with Judge Guthman about it. Now, you think with that group of people with that professional background, it would be hard to reach consensus even on what time of day it is. But we were able to reach consensus on a lot of issues, and that's what I'm here to talk about right now. One consensus we reached is that it had to be clarity that attorneys had to be able to access the data necessary for them to do their jobs, regardless if it's private or not. So we added that to make sure that they can continue to do their job. Employees, whether county recorders, title examiners, whether direct employees or contract employees of the county or the cities, still can have access to that data. None of that changes. Again, we want that smooth market to continue as it has so for so many years. Also, most importantly, I really can't emphasize this much as what I'd like to, but judicial officers must do the legwork. I'll say that one more time. Judicial officers must do the legwork. Nothing happens automatically. If I want to have my data protected or my home address protected, I need to take the affirmative steps. I need to not only go to the correct office and identify myself, I need to tell that office what specific document I'm talking about. It's not just, you know, I'm Judge Todd Shuffleman, here's my form, make all my information private. No, I need to tell them exactly what document number, parcel number. So I need to do that work. Again, try to take as much of that responsibility, relieve that responsibility from the counties as much as what we can do. Also, and it's different than the federal law. So our chief judge might be a little surprised if when this law passes, he has to do the legwork as opposed to what's in the federal law, but, you know, it is what it is. Also, it only applies to current addresses. For instance, I've lived in my current address since about 2021. Where I lived before that is of no consequence to this bill. So there's no need to go back in time beyond, for me, 2021. And you think as the people of different age groups and who is going to be covered, remember, we're only talking about the current address. Also, there's a $40 fee involved. And that wasn't a fee that I said, that's all I'm going to pay as member of this committee, you better adopt it. No, that was brought by broad consensus discussion of everyone in the work group, and we came up with that number. Each property needs its own request. In other words, let's say I have a home, I have a cabin, I may have something else. Each one of those requires its own separate request, its own separate legwork. It doesn't happen on its own. Doesn't cover track books, those old historical documents that you see and buried a lot of times in the basement of buildings. I used to work with those. They track back to when the state began back to the state, usually owned the land or the railroad owned the land. It doesn't go back in time that far. Again, we're trying to relieve as much of that responsibility as possible off of the county officials. So again, I'll wrap up in respect to the time. Nothing happens to the real estate records until the judicial official files a correct form. You pass the bill, nothing changes until I take the steps I've talked about. The counties don't need to go into searching mass records for everybody who works for the judicial branch. No, they don't have to do that. We do that. It's our responsibility to do that. Only protects the current addresses. And I was watching some other testimony and information. There seemed to have been a misunderstanding. I want to make it very clear, there's no obligation for a county or government official to scrub the internet. There seemed to have been a misconception that if my data was public and somebody got it, which they can, that if I then request it make private, Anoka County then has to go search the internet and find out who got it. If that makes sense, there seems to be a misconception. There's no affirmative duty on a county to track down what's been released in the internet. I make that very clear. We're not asking that at all, and it wouldn't even be possible.
Okay, and Judge, I really have to ask you to wrap up.
And I actually, good time. That was my last bullet
point. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. So, members, we are going to lay over this bill. We have 4 people who want to testify on it, and we have another bill that we must get to because we have a testifier who's traveled a long way. So I'm going to ask to go to Mr. Neumeister and ask you to be super quick, no more than 2 minutes, knowing that we're going to lay this over. And again, members, if we bring it up again, if there things get worked out here, we will have discussion at that time before we move the bill, of course. Okay, welcome, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, or co-chairs, if I can get the thumbs up at 30 seconds like last time, that would be very helpful. First of all, I did written testimony. It's very clear where I stand on this. Number two, this is of limited security. I mean, you can go out, it's a modern day world. I have been able to find judges' addresses on the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, just by doing internet search. You can easily pay someone $5 or, you know, with one of the data things. Yes, this is of limited, and I get the goal. The thing, though, that I want to share with you are what happened with last year's law and this law. So if you look on 2 different standards. So if you look on page 1-8, starting at 110, you'll see on that law all data is private in government files, which is basically the personal information. And then you'll see, following on, is that a notice has to be sent in order to get the remedies under the Data Practices Act if the data is released by government entities. Now, what this bill does, the new bill, it says classification, this is on page 5, line 2, classification of data, but then if you go to line 5, or page 5, line 15, it only takes effect when you send a notice. And then number 3, if you go back, if you go over to page 7, line 18, that data becomes unpublic when the judicial official is no longer a judicial official. In the current law, all the data is private, and it continues to be private even when a person is no longer a judicial official. I would like to say the new standards that you're putting in, maybe put in some aspects of it to the new law. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Very good. You're a master. Thank you.
It's my 2 cents.
All right.
And you have also my testimony.
Thank you. Amber Bouget and then Andrew McGuire. If you would both come up, or that would be great so that we can move right along. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairs and committee members. My name is Amber Bouget. I'm the County Recorder and Registrar of Titles for Hennepin County. I'm also the co-chair for the Minnesota County Recorders Association Legislative Committee, which is part of the Minnesota Association of County Officers. So in addition to representing recorders, I'm also here on behalf of other county officers, including auditors and treasurers. As our concerns also deal with assessment and tax records. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you very much to the Judicial Safety Working Group, for which I was also a part of, for addressing some of our concerns. While this legislation amendment makes significant progress, we have still have some deep concerns. To comply with the retroactive privatization of judicial officials' personal information, it is essential to narrow the law scope to real property records made publicly accessible online. Identifying and redacting information in tax, assessment, and other property records is particularly challenging. This is due to diverse digital formats such as scanned PDFs and microfilm. Historical records are not necessarily indexed or stored by parcel. This requires staff to sift through them, causing significant staff time and resources. Limiting the scope to those records made publicly available online is a reasonable request that will help remedy these issues while helping protect the safety of judicial officials. Additionally, classifying judicial officials' personal information as private under Chapter 13 exposes government entities to extensive legal remedies and, not designed for real property records, which are critical to commerce, property rights, and transparency. Much of this personal information is already widely available through other means. For these reasons, the County Recorders Association and Association of County Officers cannot support the bill without a limitation on liability. We propose a $5,000 limit.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I understand we have written testimony as well from you. Thank you very much. Andrew McGuire, please go ahead.
Good morning, Chairs Liebling and Scott, and committee members. My name is Andrew McGuire. I am the property records manager at Dakota County, but I'm speaking as a representative from the Minnesota County Recorders Association and the Minnesota County Officers Association. Dakota County has no official stance on the legislation. Thank you for taking the time to hear testimony on this matter. I appreciate the opportunity to collaborate and craft legislation that will both serve the community need while allowing counties to provide efficient and effective service. I would like to share with you one of the unforeseen consequences of this bill that may give us pause. The scope of this legislation is expanding exponentially. What began as protection for judges numbering about 300 was expanded to cover 2,500 judicial staff. Since the beginning of the session, county attorneys and peace officers have also worked to expand the definitions to cover themselves. There are over 10,000 peace officers in Minnesota. This is consistent with what we have seen in every other state that has introduced similar language. The number of protected groups will expand. For each of Minnesota's 87 counties, there will be unique challenges in implementing and administering this legislation. As housekeeping bills are passed or other groups become covered, these challenges will only grow. Uniformity in process and efficacy will undoubtedly suffer as our ability to vet the applicants, mask their records, and facilitate access to their privatized data will be strained. For some of our smaller counties, the strain will be amplified as there are fewer people employed that can perform these types of tasks. We would ask that the authors consider that an administrative authority would be able to efficiently handle enhancements in communication with the protected persons and other government agencies. As Safe at Home is overseen by the Office of the Secretary of State, so too will this program need oversight. Thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to continuing to collaborate on legislation that will allow local governments to efficiently fulfill the needs of those needing protections.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And then we have Nathan Zacharias. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nathan Zacharias. I'm the technology policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. You have a very detailed letter in your packets. I won't belabor much of what's been said already. We are concerned about precedent setting in the broader sense. A lot of other public employee groups have come up and asked perhaps for similar protections, and we anticipate many more in the future. And as was already said, we are very concerned about our small rural counties. We struggle with workforce retention and recruitment. Keeping employees in these offices to do this work, it's laborious, but important. The threats are real, and we do think that everybody should feel safe in their home. With that, I'll conclude. I know the committee is on a tight timeline, but we do appreciate working with the judges and the other groups on the stakeholder process and want to continue to do so to refine that scope. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being quick, and thank you, Representative Curran. And I know that the advocates and the folks with concerns are going to keep working together because this is a real problem that does deserve a real solution. With that, I'm going to lay over House File 2127 as amended. Thank you, Representative Curran. Representative Feist, House File 104. Representative Feist is going to move House File 104 that it be placed to be placed on the general register. And there is a DE3. Amendment. And Representative Feist, I assume you want to move the DE3 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. The DE3 amendment gets the bill into the shape that we'd like, and it also incorporates really helpful input from Representative Hudson, making language around mandated reporters more explicit. And
all
that
right.
is at line 1.17.
Okay, so Representative Feist is moving adoption of the DE3 amendment to put the bill in the order in which she'd like to discuss it. All in favor, please. Please. Okay, well, let's adopt the DE3, and I know there's an A1, and we'll adopt that afterwards. So all in favor of adoption of the DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE3 is adopted. And then the A1 amendment to the DE3 that we just adopted looks like it makes a technical change.
Correct.
So, so Representative Feist moves the A1 amendment to the DE3. All in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, go ahead, Representative Feist.
Forgot my notes, and I'm just grabbing them. Well, I'm going to be extemporaneous because the written comments that I worked really hard on are not in my packet. So, actually, no, I found them. You don't have to hear me be extemporaneous. I am pleased to bring House File 104 to this committee. It has two bipartisan or Republican authors in the Senate, and I've really appreciated the engagement by my Republican colleagues on this bill in the House. I've been working closely with system leaders and advocates for victims on this effort for the past year. I'm constantly inspired by their vision for a legal system that better centers victims and considers what they need to heal and move on. Under this legislation, statements made in the context of a restorative practice setting would be inadmissible in court, similar to the privilege that exists for alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. It is equally important to the successes of restorative practices as it is for ADR for there to be a legally safe space for dialogue so that the offender can accept responsibility for their actions without the possibility of their open, honest statements being used against them in another context. What this bill does not do is interfere with the traditional legal mechanisms for holding offenders accountable. Prosecutors can simultaneously or at a later date bring offenders to justice regardless of whether the victim chooses to explore a restorative path to accountability. This bill simply clearly delineates the bounds of the two separate processes and carves out important exceptions so information can be shared when necessary to protect public safety. We know from local and national statistics from the National Crime Victimization Survey and hearing from victims, survivors directly, that the majority of crimes, more than half of violent crimes, over two-thirds of property crimes, and nearly 75% of sexual assaults go unreported, either because of feelings of shame or embarrassment, fear of retaliation, or not being believed, or not liking the options for accountability in the justice system. In order for us to truly be victim-centered, we have to listen to victims and provide more options for them to get meaningful accountability and the healing that they deserve. This is what victims have told me they want, and that is why I'm here today. And I will leave it at that, and I'll turn it over to testifiers.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Feist. So why don't you, testifier, go ahead, state your name.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Amanda Sealing. I'm from Yellow Medicine County, which is actually a small county in western Minnesota. I'm the traveler, so it was about a three-hour drive to get here. For over 15 years, I prosecuted sexual assault cases, juvenile delinquency cases, child protection cases in my small county, and today I'm here to ask you for your support for HF 104. I don't know how familiar you are with restorative practices, so I'm going to take just a second to kind of explain some of the nuts and bolts. In Yellow Medicine County, for almost 25 years, we've been using a restorative practice called CIRCLE. This is just one type of restorative practice, but through CIRCLE, we've significantly reduced out-of-home placements and the costs associated with those, as well as recidivism, while simultaneously holding young people accountable for their actions. Other types of restorative practices are being used across the state in a variety of case types in a variety of jurisdictions, ranging from petty offenses to serious violent felonies. One of the fundamental tenets of restorative practices across the board is confidentiality. During the CIRCLE process, learning happens through storytelling. Volunteers tell their stories, young people or the offender tell their stories, the victims tell their stories, and making agreements to make sure that things that we say stay, be continue to stay in circle. So what's said in circle stays in circle. That's one of the premises. And so in HF 104, we're actually proposing that the things that get said in circle get some legal protection. There's already a legal structure for confidentiality in similar things. I think that you should think of this as kind of analogous to the ADR process, right? So in 595.02 subdivision 1A, they actually carved out an exception to the ADR process. Let's be clear, this doesn't change the evidence that exists. Right? Cases can still be prosecuted using all of the evidence that exists outside of the restorative process that's being used. It just protects the statements that are made during the restorative practice for the purposes of the restorative practice. This is a necessary change for restorative practices and for all participants across the state. The research is clear. When offenders take accountability for their actions, they're actually less likely to reoffend and public safety increases. When offenders take accountability for their actions, it benefits the healing process for victims. Confidentiality in circles and restorative practices encourages accountability. Please support HF 104.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's have, we have next testifier. I think we have Sarah Super and Alicia Nichols. Oh, no, we don't have those testifiers? Okay.
They're here, but I think for time.
All right. And we have another testifier, Sandra Weiss, who wanted to come up. And members, we can go just a few minutes over, and hopefully we'll be able to complete the bill. Welcome to the committee. If you could keep your comments just really brief. Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chair Liebling and Scott and the committee. Thank you for listening to me. My name is Sandra Weiss. I'm a local restaurateur, mentor, speaker, board member, advocate, daughter, and lifelong Minnesotan. I'm here to share my strong support of House File 104. As an adult in my 40s, I was attacked in the dark and raped like an animal by a known acquaintance. House File 104 is a tool for victims like me to mitigate our needs after such a vicious violation. This bill can foster reclaiming consent, apologies, and maybe even forgiveness one day that deeply matters. The tool can help both sides understand, make amends safely, and possibly heal. This tool is not for everyone, but will be invaluable for those that choose it. Our existing tools aren't working when a 40-something woman who is educated, successful, sober, and who's a cop's daughter does not feel comfortable reporting. If she questions she will be believed, who can successfully report? The terror of wondering if traditional reporting will actually help her or further devastate her life and the person causing the harm is a spirit-crushing reality of sexual assault reporting. That is why so few people report. Immediately after an assault, shock floods your body. Even brilliant minds fall victim to their faculties, failing them after sexual assault. It's a blur. Your worldview is immediately off-kilter. Traumatic shock is a defense mechanism that helps protect your brain and body. It's accompanied by a range of physical and emotional symptoms, numbness, confusion, disassociation, and time and space seem foggy. Immediately, a rape victim is harshly judged on their ability to recall linear time, critical thought, and sharp details, all while physically tending to wounds, pain, shock, and insomnia. Making life-altering decisions is not recommended during a major life event, yet rape victims must instantly choose a course or wait and be judged as less believable because she waited. I'm almost done. Yeah. Most sexual assault cases are what is called he said, she said. And the courts, lawyers, and mediators will very quickly tell victims that they are very hard to charge and win. So it feels like society pushes victims to report, yet nothing happens. 6% of rapes are reported. These numbers may vary. 3% of those reported are charged. We have a flaming issue here. Victim needs a meaningful process or why bother reporting? House Bill 104 allows victims to participate in a restorative justice process that is humane and finally their choice. Healing and moving on with life is more likely through mutual recognition of the mistake, and that's unheard of in a current civil process. When those have caused harm face their impact or their mistake, like she said, the awareness could potentially stop future harm. It's similar to the historic old-fashioned ways of community members brokered restoration together with both sides.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Okay. Had this bill been available to me, I could have experienced healing, fairness, hope, and the justice I would have surely sought in a meaningful way much sooner. Today, I'm asking for your support of House File 104.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thanks.
So, members, let's go to discussion. We have just a few minutes, but, discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And perhaps it's in the bill here somewhere. If you're in one of these circles and a perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, admits to a crime that maybe he was charged for but not convicted because there was lack of evidence, what then?
So the way it works in Yellow Medicine
Ms. Sealing. Go ahead.
I'm a professor now, so I'm used to really informal conversations. The way it works in Yellow Medicine County is a youth gets charged with an offense. A person gets charged with an offense, and they make in Yellow Medicine, they make a factual statement on the record about the offense, and then they get referred to Circle. And the conversations that happen in Circle are the things that we need to be protecting, not the things that happen in court or anything that happened before court happened. In other counties, they actually get referred as more of a diversion process through the county attorney's office. And similarly, whatever agreements get made in order to make the referral to the restorative practice, those are the things that we're protecting are the things that actually occurred during the restorative practice. And so it doesn't affect the evidence that happened that led up to the charge. It doesn't affect any of the evidence that we've collected and gathered through investigation. It simply protects the conversations that occur through the restorative practice. Does that make sense?
Representative Scott?
Thank you. Yeah, it does. One of my hesitancies with all of this, and maybe you have some data on the effectiveness of this, but these are some really serious crimes that we're talking about, and I have a certain level of hesitancy and really uncomfortableness because I don't want to be letting anybody off that has done a heinous crime like this. And so, Representative Feist, is there data that, like, proves that this is restorative?
Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Scott. And I would be happy to share with you some data. I have a PowerPoint just talking about the impact on reduced recidivism. I think really remarkably, when you look at data around victim, it's kind of a weird way to phrase it, like victim satisfaction. But off the top of my head, I believe it's like 94% of people who have been harmed who turn to a restorative process feel that that process like met their personal needs. And I think 24% off the top of my head, but I think I'm right, 24% of victims see the traditional legal process as something that was healing and met their needs. So I think that it's very clear from the data that restorative practices are what victims want, but there is also really good data around reduced recidivism, reduced incarceration as a result. And Yellow Medicine County is so amazing because they founded their department, I think, 2001, and you've been involved since the beginning. And so, like, we have really wonderful data in Minnesota, like, from Yellow Medicine County in terms of how it's impacted their, you know, cost savings from reduced out-of-home placement, specifically for kids. And I'll turn it over if you have anything specific to
Professor
add.
Sealing.
Thank you. I actually wanted to affirm and validate those concerns because those were the same concerns that I had 24 years ago when we first started this process. I was a baby prosecutor, and the idea of turning over my case to the community to handle it terrified me because I didn't think that they'd be public safety oriented enough, and I didn't think that they'd do enough to protect our community. And what I found is that I was wrong. I was simply wrong. We are much better off in the justice system if the community is assisting and holding people accountable because we have one probation officer, one judge, one prosecutor dealing with that offender otherwise. When we have the whole community helping that offender rehabilitate and come back to community, it's a much more effective way to prevent recidivism. And so I would encourage you, come on out and join us in Yellow Medicine County. We'd love to show you how the process works. But that's a slightly separate issue than this. But, and I think the really important thing to keep in mind is that this doesn't protect offenders at all. This allows offenders to go into a space with community members to take accountability for their actions. And it allows the victims to also come into that space and hear an apology. I spent years prosecuting people who wrote an apology letter. I don't know if you've ever gotten an apology letter, but it's not very meaningful. When I can look you in the eyes and you say out loud that I'm sorry for the thing that I did, and I can ask why, it's a much more powerful place for an apology to come from.
Professor Sealing, this doesn't give anybody the right to go through that process as opposed to the court process, right?
That's correct.
This is a decision that judges make about whether to allow this to occur?
Yes, and it allows for systems. In a lot of counties, it's a system-based system or a system-based program. In other counties, it's handled in a variety of ways. Nobody is required. Nobody... Right. is allowed to override other people's decisions.
And this bill doesn't change any of that. All this bill does is protect those statements so that it can be more effective. This is a process that's already happening, and this bill is allowing it to actually be more effective. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Feist?
Yeah, and I would just also add that this is something that the victims can choose. In no circumstances would this bill impact what rights people who have been charged or who have, you know, caused harm, what rights they would have. It just creates that space for that dialogue.
All right. So we're kind of running out of time here. Is any other member comment? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And when we came into the committee hearing this today, we were under the impression this bill was going to be laid over. And so my members are having concerns that the motion was to be made to go to the general register. And I don't know if it's your day to chair, so you can do as you wish. But I think some of our members have concerns, and so I will just say that.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Scott. What I would say is, you know, I think the author wants to vote it out of committee today. It'll go to the general register. Obviously, we're a divided legislature. I think that Representative Feist is well known for working across the aisle, and I think we'll be open to people's comments. I just have known her to work that way over the years, and clearly this bill isn't going to go and pass off the floor if we don't have buy-in from a lot of members. So, you know, I think it would be good to move the bill today. Notwithstanding that members might still be a little bit uncertain about it, and I think the process can continue even though it would move to the general register. And Representative Feist, closing comment?
Yeah, thank you. And I commit to working with my colleagues across the aisle. This bill cannot pass without bipartisan support. So, you know, we're moving it today, but conversations absolutely can continue. I really believe in this bill. I'm so grateful for the experts, the survivors, the system players who I've worked with on this for the past year, and I would be really grateful for your support today. Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 104 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the general register. Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, members, apologies to those bills that we didn't get to. Those will get placed on a later agenda, and we are adjourned.